Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, we'll visit the Stephen Foster Folk Culture Center State Park in White Springs.
It's an absolute beautiful park. The history, the culture, we hold a lot of events here. Such as the Dulcimer Retreat, old-time country folk music, of course, our Florida Folk Festival.
We'll talk about murder in antebellum Florida.
Denham and Roth argue that, quote, political instability, poor law enforcement, and political alienation thus made Florida an extraordinarily homicidal place.
And we'll discuss Cuban consulates in Key West. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. Probably best known as the site of the Florida Folk Festival, the oldest event of its kind in America, held every Memorial Day weekend, the Stephen Foster Folk Culture Center State Park in White Springs is also home to a plantation-style museum and a bell tower with a carillon. Although Stephen Foster never visited Florida, he wrote the song Old Folks at Home, also known as Way Down Upon the Suwannee River, which was named the Florida State Song in 1935. In 2008, the original lyrics of the song that romanticized slavery were revised. It was members of the family who started the Lilly Pharmaceutical Company who wanted to honor Foster's memory. Robert Townsend is a member of the citizen support organization that helps operate the museum and bell tower.
Back in the early 30s, one of the Lilly family came down from Chicago to Jacksonville, Florida, looking to create a memorial in honor of Stephen Collins Foster, one of America's first composers. He was a big fan of Mr. Foster's. So he got in connection with the Florida Federation of Music Clubs, and they combined their efforts and decided to build a memorial for Stephen Collins Foster. They began raising money and public support. They were looking for a site, and they had three requirements. It had to be on the Suwannee River. It had to be out of the floodplain, and it had to be near a major highway. Well, back then, I-75 wasn't here. The main thoroughfare north and south was US 41. So they chose this site because it does not flood. The other parks they looked at on the Suwannee River do flood. So by 1936, they had convinced the Florida legislature to make the Way Down Upon the Suwannee River the state song for Florida. Stephen Collins Foster has two state songs, My Old Kentucky Home, of course, for Kentucky. They began construction and still raising money and getting the legislator involved. They realized the project was way too large for them to take on anymore. So they turned it over to the state of Florida, and that's who finished out the park.
The plantation-style museum at the Stephen Foster Folk Culture Center State Park features mechanical dioramas that depict some of Stephen Foster's most famous songs from the mid-1800s, including Camptown Races, I Dream of Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair, Old Black Joe, and of course, Way Down Upon the Suwannee River. Robert Townsend.
The dioramas in our museum here are all handcrafted, hand-painted, handmade. They are 75 years old. It took 12 artisans 2 years living on site to make these dioramas. They are not today's animatronics. They are operated by small cables, electric motors, and pulleys. They have quite a few tricks in them where they used light illusion to make it like the water was moving or shimmering on the lake or the river, rather. And they are also, like I said, 75 years old.
Stephen Foster was the most popular American songwriter of his time. Many of his songs were written for minstrel shows where white performers wore blackface, singing songs that romanticized slavery and denigrated black people. Newer signage at the Stephen Foster Folk Culture Center Museum is labeled Reconsidering the Dioramas. This signage clarifies the dangerous racial stereotypes of minstrel shows and the harsh realities of slavery. Robert Townsend points out the detailed craftsmanship that went into the dioramas.
Well, way down upon the Suwannee River has a river view, and it has two paddle boats on it. And the artists were so concerned about making this accurate that the paddle wheel on the back of the boat are timed to actually be spinning that fast to make the boat move at the speed it's moving. The river itself, if you look at the river, it's blue and gray and white. It has a shimmer on it like it's moving. That's created by a light illusion with aluminum foil under the diorama. Camptown Races, if you look at Camptown Races, the first set of horses are very close to you. The actual diorama itself is just over 2 foot deep, but it's made to mimic the distance of an actual width of a horse track. The second set of horses you see go by are miniaturized, and behind them is the stadium and the people, the seating for the people that are there. It's rather unique how they did that distance.
The mechanically animated dioramas from the mid-20th century require regular maintenance to keep running.
Unfortunately, some of the artisans that not made them, but to help us keep them up, have passed on. So we do have some park staff, park rangers that are learning how to work on them. The main maintenance is once in a while a small electric motor will burn out, or maybe one of the chains will jump the track, and of course you have to keep the tracks lubricated. We try not to touch any of the artistry because it is very delicate and very valuable. We do have one horse-drawn wagon we have to take out for repairs, but basically it's just keeping them clean, servicing them, and making sure that the chains are oiled properly and they don't jump the track.
In addition to the unique dioramas, the museum at the Stephen Foster Folk Culture Center State Park displays antique musical instruments. Also on display are two large paintings by Howard Chandler Christie called Beautiful Dreamer and Many Happy Days I Squandered that are visualizations of Foster's songs. Robert Townsend.
Well, back in the 50s, right after they opened, people started wanting to donate pianos. And what I have learned through research is the pianos were actually operable at the time. They are not now. They're just simply antique pianos. There's some very unique pianos. We do have a baby grand in the bell tower that came from Carnegie Hall. It's playable. We do have an upright in the museum that's playable. It's not a valuable piano, but it is playable. From time to time, we'll have artists come in and play on the piano. Hanging over the mantles on either side of the museum are two beautiful works of art, 20 by 20, that were done by an artist by the name of Christie. His most famous work is a oil painting, 30 by 50, I believe, that is of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, and it hangs in Washington, D.C.
The carillon in the bell tower at Stephen Foster Folk Culture Center State Park was originally built for the Florida exhibit at the 1939 World's Fair and was installed in the park's bell tower in 1958. It was damaged by a storm about 7 years ago, but Robert Townsend says that restoration is underway and nearing completion.
In the bell tower, the entire interior structure is of pink marble out of North Georgia. We do have the original clock, the timer that would run the bells, and we do have a keyboard that you would sit and play the bells with. Those will be kept for historic significance. We're refurbishing the bells at this time. The new keyboard and timer will be on a wall behind that, so there won't be public access to it. But we will be able to play the bells at a little faster pace. The older model was built in the 40s, and when you would strike the key and the dormer would strike the bell, if you played too fast, the dormers could not keep up with you.
In the 1950s, a Mrs. Montgomery was one of the only people allowed to play the bell tower carillon.
And she actually wanted to do a recording of the bells in 1958. So I found in archives four albums, 33 and a third albums, of recording of the bells from 1958. And the history I found is that Mrs. Montgomery did not want any vehicular noise or bird noise while she was doing the recording. Keep in mind, 441 was a major thoroughfare north and south, so there had been a lot of traffic noise. So she convinced the people doing the recording to come in at earlier than 4 o'clock in the morning, and that's when she recorded those albums. They are in archives. We did do a record. We did have them placed on a CD, so that when we're archiving, we have two speakers up on the mezzanine floor, and we can play those so people hear how the bell sounded until we get our bells restored.
It's hoped that the bells in Stephen Foster Folk Culture Center State Park will be playing again this summer.
The bells were damaged in 2018 by water got over into the superstructure and got into the 1940s electronics, so we had to shut down. We started restoration in 2019. When they got up there to do the restoration, they discovered the dormers that strike the Carillion tubes were covered in asbestos, the material of the time. So we had to shut down. They did an abatement all of 2019. And then, of course, COVID hit in 2020, and we were shut for over a year. So we're a little behind schedule, but they are telling us within the next 60 to 90 days we're going to have the bells play.
We spoke with Robert Townsend at the 72nd Annual Florida Folk Festival, but he points out that the Stephen Foster Folk Culture Center State Park is a great resource year-round.
It's an absolute beautiful park. The history, the culture, we hold a lot of events here, such as the Dulcimer Retreat, old-time country folk music, of course, our Florida Folk Festival, which is going on now. It does hold a lot of cultural information. We also work with University of Florida in doing oral histories here, not only for the Folk Festival in the park, but what we call the Suwannee Valley area. And we're very pleased to have the number of people that have consented to coming in and being interviewed about their lives and history in the Tri-County area.
Robert Townsend is a member of the citizen support organization that helps operate the museum and bell tower at Stephen Foster Folk Culture Center State Park in White Springs. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture. Subscribe to our journal, the Florida Historical Quarterly. Watch our public television series, Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, in the antebellum period, Florida had a reputation as a place where life was not highly valued. Death often came quickly and violently.
In their fall 2007 article in the Florida Historical Quarterly, James M. Denham, a professor at Florida Southern College, and Randolph Roth, an associate professor at Ohio State University and co-founder of the Historical Violence Database, present a quantitative study of homicides in Florida during the period 1821 to 1861. Their opening paragraph defines the homicidal tendencies of Floridians. Quote, "Before the Civil War, Florida was one of the most murderous places in the United States. Its homicide rate was rivaled only by Texas and California. When it came to murders of or by blacks, Florida was typical for a slave state. But its white citizens killed each other at an extraordinary rate, usually three or four times the rate in most other slave states, and 8 to 10 times the prevailing rate during the Seminole War 1835 to 1841 and the Secession Crisis 1858 to 1861, end quote. Placing the Florida homicide rate in context, Denham and Roth explain that the homicide rate among whites in all slaveholding states was high. They attribute this phenomenon to the recognition among poor and middle-class whites who, following the optimism for remaking society engendered by the Revolutionary War, quote, grew impatient with their standing in society, and prominent whites resented the challenges to their authority, which led to deadly confrontations, end quote. A second source of rising homicides was the state's troubled political history. California and Texas likewise experienced political instability and posted similarly high homicide rates. But no state experienced more difficulty in establishing a strong, legitimate government than Florida. Florida's territorial government, which lasted for a quarter century, was considered by most citizens as corrupt and ineffectual, a perception that encouraged vigilantism that frequently initiated a cycle of killings and revenge killings. Denham and Roth argue that, quote, political instability, poor law enforcement, and political alienation thus made Florida an extraordinarily homicidal place, end quote.
Connie, today we can find crime statistics online with the click of a mouse. The work required to research and analyze homicide rates in antebellum Florida must have been daunting. A territory too disorganized to protect its citizens with a strong police presence would not keep good records.
In what can be called an understatement, Denham and Roth observe, quote, determining Florida's homicide rate offers special challenges, end quote. Court minute books, most case files, and coroner's inquests have been lost. Local newspapers, where available, seldom reported homicides. In place of the usual sources, Denham and Roth used financial records listing payments for arrests, confinement, and trials of homicide suspects, plus the proclamations that called upon citizens and local authorities to apprehend fugitive murder suspects to assess the homicide rate. These sources seldom describe the murders or even identify the murder victim, but they do document 404 homicides were committed in Florida between 1821 and 1861. Of those, 10 were committed by Native Americans and 51 by African Americans. Although nothing is known about 30% of the cases, the law provides a window into black-on-white homicide. All blacks found guilty of murder of whites were sentenced to death. Black-on-black homicides resulted in a manslaughter conviction and whipping. In the interest of time, I will summarize Denham and Roth's detailed methodology to reach their conclusion on the final numbers they projected for Florida in this period. But I would encourage you to read the article to understand the way in which important history can be rediscovered using limited records and statistical analysis. Teasing out information from the existing records and subjecting that data to statistical analysis, they estimate that 607 homicides occurred during the period of study. Applying the formula that the FBI uses to calculate murder rates, the study demonstrated that Florida antebellum murder rate among whites was significantly higher than that of other southern states. It never fell below 36 per 100,000. And during the Second Seminole War reached 71 per 100,000. By comparison, the homicide rate in Virginia was 5 to 6 per 100,000. In three Georgia counties, 10 to 15 per 100,000. And Edgefield, South Carolina, 13 per 100,000. Horry, South Carolina, had a murder rate of 27 per 100,000. Nationally, only California and Texas had comparable rates. In the slave South as a whole, the homicide rate was 10 to 15 per 100,000, quote, at least twice what it had been for whites at its low point in the Chesapeake in the late 1750s and 1760s, and three times what it had been for blacks in the 1780s and 1790s, end quote. Denham and Roth argue that the lower homicide rates in the late 18th century provide strong evidence against claims the antebellum homicide rate can be explained by the presence of slavery or the traditional code of honor. In the South, the Revolutionary War failed to overturn the social hierarchy that characterized life under British rule. This frustrated the hopes and expectations for social and economic advancement for poor and middle-class whites. The Revolution did not abolish slavery, as it did in other nations in the Age of Revolution. Southern elites found the rough and tumble of democracy an affront to their position. As a result, quote, impatience with restraint and sensitivity to insult was more intense in the slave South after the Revolution, and the region had more than its share of deadly quarrels, property disputes, duels, and interracial killings, end quote. With 45% of its population enslaved, Florida's homicide problem mirrored that of other states with large enslaved populations. Denham and Roth concluded, quote, homicide rates among unrelated men rise during periods of political instability and conflict and decline during periods of political harmony. They rise when the bonds of race or nationality or community are weak and fall when they are strong. Like Texas and California, Florida never enjoyed the degree of political harmony that other states did in the antebellum period. Floridians experienced divisive political battles, corrupt territorial government, and persistent struggles for control among Anglos, Hispanics, and Native Americans. They were on the wrong side of the crisis over slavery and were scorned by the federal government. Their homicide rates reflected their political history, end quote.
Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. We began the program up in the Panhandle at White Springs, and we end all the way down in Key West as Sebastian Garcia has this look at Cuban consulates.
Arturo Sebastian Gonzalez is a PhD history student at the University of Miami. His research focuses on how Cuban migrants influenced political changes on and off the island throughout the long history of Cuban-American relations. Arturo presented at the recent Florida Historical Society annual meeting and symposium. His panel presentation was titled, Everyday Tasks and Hidden Agendas, Cuban Consulates, Florida's Operations. Immediately after Cuba achieved independence from Spain in 1902, the Cuban state established several consulates across the United States, particularly in Florida. Cuban consuls' everyday task included assignments not so different from what consulates do today, such as facilitating economic relations between the two populations, issuing business visas, and paying import taxes for shipped goods. However, Arturo explains that during his early period of the Cuban Republic, there was a more concealed or hidden agenda behind establishing these consulates.
These consular offices also served a secondary purpose as part of a security apparatus that was intended to protect the Cuban Republic from Cuban emigres who sought to overthrow the government of the day.
Historians have thoroughly documented the political relationship between the diasporic Cuban community and the island's government regime, particularly during political transformations such as the Cuban War of Independence in the late 19th century or since Fidel Castro took over in 1959. However, such connections have not been adequately examined during the roughly half-century gap between those two momentous events.
In that in-between time, in what we call the Republican era from 1902 to 1959, there continued to be a few dissident elements in the Cuban emigre communities who at various times sought to overthrow the constitutional order or what they claimed was actually an unconstitutional order on the Republic from their place of residence, which could be Key West, Tampa, New York, and once Miami got established, the Magic City.
Interestingly, the consul in Key West was Domingo Milord, an emigre. Being at the intersection of the Cuban emigre and diplomatic communities enabled Milord to operate and connect with both groups.
In 1919, Domingo Milord was appointed to be the Key West consul, and he was himself an emigre. Now, that means that his interests were not different from his fellow emigres, and in communicating with the Cuban government in Havana, he was really operating in this in-between position. And that middle position gave him a lot of cachet among the Cubans of Key West.
One example in particular that demonstrates Milord's influence as an emigre consul, and by extension the significance of the Cuban consulate network in Florida, was in 1924, when a minor revolt broke out in Santa Clara, Cuba.
The Cuban ambassador to the United States, Cosme de la Torriente, convinced the U.S. State Department to impose an embargo on all arms shipments to Cuba and he ordered all the consuls to be vigilant and to report any activity that might violate this order. So in Key West, the local consul, Milord, he goes into gear. He gets this order and he creates a poster himself and posts it in all of the public places where he knew that Cubans congregated, the plazas, the restaurants. And of course, he was able to do this because he himself was a Cuban emigre. So this was like him going to his usual spots anyway, but this time with a poster in tow. And we know that this poster was actually effective because on May 6th, after he had gotten the word out and sounded the alarm, a local Cuban emigre living in Key West informed him of a plot.
The plot seemingly involved a man smuggling arms to the Cuban rebels supporting the revolt in Santa Clara. With the assistance of the local Coast Guard commander, Milord further investigated the plot to quickly discover that there was no evidence to support such accusations. Nevertheless, the 1924 Santa Clara revolt was ultimately suppressed partly because of the broader consular network in Florida, operated by diplomats like Milord, whom one newspaper described as an acclaimed representative for La Colonia Cubana, the Cuban colony. Arturo explains why such language exemplifies the significance of these Cuban consulates during the early Republic era.
A colony that has the implication of political links to a metropole. Now, Key West was a territory of the United States through and through, and it, you know, must be considered U.S. territory. But that language of there being a Cuban colony in Key West, I think there's two ways to take it. One is the very romantic way to say, well, it's a colony in that their links to the Cuban homeland are cultural, that, you know, they are invoking a immigrant past. But I think that in reviewing some of this diplomatic correspondence, that term, Cuban colony, it actually does reference some political links that continue to exist between the Republic of Cuba and the Cuban emigres who were operating under U.S. sovereignty, and yet nevertheless, they were still in some ways subject to the authority of the Cuban Republic.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida, Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. You can also listen as a podcast or online at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.